You're listening to a Lewis and Clark podcast. Visit us online at www.lclark.edu.
Erica Thorson, clinical professor of law at the International Environmental Law Project, was in Morocco recently working with local officials to review their wildlife and customs legislation and to participate in a customs training workshop. Her efforts were part of a collaborative project with two international conservation organizations to curb the export of Barbary macaque to Europe. We sat down with Professor Thorson, talked with her about her trip and the project. So how did you get involved in this work in Morocco?
Primarily through IELP's membership in a network of organizations called the Species Survival Network, a network of over 80 NGOs, non-governmental organizations from around the world who work on wildlife issues, primarily on CITES issues, and CITES is the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. IELP plays sort of a really special role in that network, and we're often called on to do specific types of legal analysis and answer questions for these specific NGOs or on CITES-related issues that are legal in nature.
So what was the goal of this visit?
What we've seen, or what some of the organizations that we work with through SSN have seen, they've seen an increase in infant and juvenile Barbary macaques given up to sanctuaries in Europe. And so it came to light that there's a pretty significant export of Barbary macaques into Europe, basically from travelers, people in the markets, in the medinas and such in Morocco are selling juvenile or infant macaques, often misleading tourists, saying that they're full grown, but in reality they actually grow quite large and they develop huge teeth and can be really quite aggressive. And so we're seeing a large number of these monkeys then given to sanctuaries in Europe, and there isn't, in fact, enough room for them at the current rate that they're showing up in sanctuaries. And then the flip side of the problem in Morocco is that it is actually a species in peril. Habitat is being diminished, there's a significant export, and they're the only primate species other than humans to make their home in North Africa. So it is a pretty important species for the North African region, and one that we want to focus an effort on keeping in Morocco and in North Africa. Part of the real frustration and completely understandable issue is just a lack of capacity generally. So when we're talking about Morocco, for example, you know, you're talking about implementing CITES, this Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, which requires countries to issue import and export permits. And they basically have two folks working in their environmental ministry that focus on CITES issues. And so they're the ones who are technically supposed to be issuing, these two people, all of the permits for all exports of CITES-listed wildlife, which numbers over 30,000 species, not necessarily in Morocco, but 30,000 species that could be imported and exported and require. The project is much larger, but this aspect of the project was really to look at Morocco's wildlife legislation and their customs legislation, and to do our part of the project, the lawyer's part of the project, was to do an assessment basically on the adequacy of the wildlife legislation and the customs legislation. So the customs officials are ultimately the ones enforcing or implementing CITES at the borders, to see how adequate that legislation was for implementing the CITES requirements. And then the second part of it, is this legislation, this existing legislation, adequate to implement their CITES obligations? Even if it is inadequate in some way, shape, or form, to what extent can they enforce CITES through their legislation? And so it became really important to sort of meld the wildlife legislation and customs legislation to understand what customs officials could do to enforce Morocco's wildlife legislation, even as inefficient as it is or inadequate as it is to implement CITES effectively. I think we did accomplish a lot. I mean, if the goal is conservation of the Barbary macaque, I don't know that we can make a direct correlation there, but we were starting with a customs team for this training workshop. We had about 20 customs officials from around the country, and particularly from port areas where there are higher levels of Barbary macaque exports in a training room for 3 days, and we taught them about CITES, and we taught them about what import and export permits should look like. We taught them how they could use, you know, what authority they had under their customs legislation to enforce export bans or import bans in general. And they really, they came to the table not thinking at all about wildlife, not even understanding at all that they had the authority to do anything. And so even just getting those customs officials to the point where they are concerned about Barbary macaques and they're looking for them in trade, and they know that they can confiscate specimens that are in trade, and now they know what a legitimate permit should look like, and even frankly the fact that they should have a permit if they're trading many of the wildlife species that are leaving Morocco through the ports now. So I do think that a lot was accomplished, not just for the Barbary macaques, but for Morocco's wildlife in general.
Do you think many people would be surprised to know that Morocco is interested in such issues?
That's actually a really interesting question. But I don't think that they necessarily should be surprised, because, I mean, if the question is relates to the fact that Morocco is a developing country and probably has so many other priorities, we have to understand development and environment are not mutually exclusive. You know, and often the conversation, at least in international environmental circles, is about developing countries maybe carrying an unfair, disproportionate burden, environmental burden, because they weren't necessarily the ones who got us into this situation. And that's a fair conversation to have, but the upshot is that developed countries, you know, have made lots of mistakes in terms of thinking about environment and development. And there are lots of lessons learned. And so I think the upshot is that now, you know, developing countries, even though, you know, it's hard to allocate political will and capacity and, you know, technology, anything else to environmental concerns, they're always at least considered, and I think that they're always on the table. You know, these countries fundamentally lack capacity, and it's about getting capacity to those countries, and that's sort of, that was the idea behind this customs training workshop. So we went there as capacity builders and as helpers, not as do it this way, we're telling you, you know, to do this, you're not implementing CITES the way you're supposed to. I mean, that wasn't the goal at all. The goal is to say, we're here to help, we're here to have conversations with you about this, and, you know, we're here to conduct trainings because we do have this knowledge and we have funding to be here to help you. And it's about creating those sort of relationships so that capacity can be exchanged like that continually and in the future. I think ultimately, capacity is probably always the problem, even in developed countries or countries that have sufficient financial resources to adequately implement their international obligations. It's just that when you're talking about developed countries, you're talking about an allocation issue or a political will issue. And, you know, allocation and political will obviously go hand in hand. So resources are diverted for whatever reason, and, you know, and not spent on some issues for other reasons. So that can be really frustrating, especially when you're talking about countries who could totally, fully, meaningfully, robustly implement their international obligations, but choose not to ultimately. When it's a choice, it's exceptionally frustrating. And so, you know, at the heart of that, I think, and the heart of the general problem and difficulty with international environmental law is it fundamentally requires political will. And if the political will isn't there, then you either don't have law or you don't have implementation and enforcement of the law.
I'm wondering what role law school students here might have played in this project.
IELP is a clinic at the law school, and so our primary goal, or one of our primary goals, I guess, I mean, one is to serve the international environmental community, I mean, and the other is to serve law students here who want international environmental experience. And they get that 4 credit through IELP. And so last year, we actually had 3 students working on this project with us. We had students who did the initial customs legislation analysis, who you know, broke down what the different areas of authority of the customs officials were and the geographical areas where they actually had that authority. We had another student who was looking specifically at the wildlife legislation. You know, Morocco's legislation, though it's been amended relatively recently, it's pretty antiquated legislation. It's actually a hunting law from 1923, and then they've added a few other pieces of legislation that they use as sort of a suite of wildlife legislation. And so this student actually got to work at fitting all of that legislation together and sort of assessing what the overall protection scheme is for wildlife in Morocco. And then we had another student actually doing some of the factual background work and scientific research work, which is always really important for what we do. And she was working on coming up with a list of CITES-listed species in Morocco and comparing that with the lists of protected species under the legislation, so we actually knew sort of the scope of coverage of Morocco's legislation vis-a-vis CITES. Unfortunately, those students weren't able to travel with me to Morocco, but I think that they got a great experience working with another country's legislation. It was a great teaching moment for IELP, too, because we got to talk about capacity for developing countries to implement and enforce international environmental obligations in a real-life context, and it made our conversation that much more contextual and meaningful, which I think is important for the students. Mm-hmm. And is a benefit of the clinic.